Hi, everyone. Welcome to Waste 360's Nothing Wasted podcast. On every episode, we invite the most interesting people in waste, recycling, and organics to sit down with us and chat candidly about their thoughts, their work, this unique industry, and so much more. So thanks for listening and enjoy this episode. Hi, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving week. We wanted you to hear this great session, so we transformed it into a podcast. It's the ups and downs of recycling, and it was a huge hit at our recent Waste Expo Together Online. So give a listen. Hope you learn a lot, and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Now let's get started. We have lined up three great speakers who will be able to cover the gamut of issues related to the ups and downs of recycling. And so first up, we have Brent Bell. Brent is the president of WM Recycle America and vice president of recycling operations for waste management. He will be followed by Peter Wright, who's the assistant administrator for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Land and Emergency Management. And I guess ending it will be Bridget Anderson, deputy commissioner for recycling and sustainability at New York City's Department of Sanitation. You can read their individual bios on this page. For this session, we're going to have each speaker go through a few slides to set the stage, highlighting some of the issues facing recycling, and then we'll move on to a longer Q&A session. So Brent, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Anne, and thanks everyone for dialing in today. I really appreciate it. So again, I'm Brent Bell, work for Waste Management. I've been there about 23 years and most of my career in the recycling space. So lots of ups and downs we can share throughout this presentation and beyond, I think. We'll kind of get kick-started with the slides that we've prepared today. Waste Management is the largest residential recycler in North America. We manage about 15 million tons of recycled material annually. With that management of those 15 million tons comes a lot of responsibilities, making sure that we're educating our customers on what's acceptable. Moving materials is important to make sure that we have a constant in markets for these materials that we intend to recycle every day. And then making sure that we invest in the right infrastructure for geographic areas that are growing and for those parts of the country that have a great demand for recycling. On the next slide, we'll talk about contamination. So contamination has been, probably one of the downsides to recycling over the last decade or so. It's something we've been working with on our inbound customers to make sure that they're recycling the right items. We have an education program called Recycling Right that really lets those consumers know what are the right items to put in those recycling bins. One of the issues with contamination is that the safety of our employees and solid waste management workers. So the batteries, propane tanks, those can cause explosions within a recycling facility and can cause fires with trucks and on the tip floors of recycling facilities. So we've got to make sure that this infrastructure that we built to recycle can stay in place and operate on a daily basis. The other piece on contamination is it impacts the good people that recycle. So the good materials get impacted by those contaminants that are in the bins. And so we spent a lot of time educating those folks. I think in 2018, our average residue rate was really high, about 25%. In 2019 and 2020, we've seen those levels drop below 20%. Still a lot of room for improvement. But nonetheless, we are improving and we're moving in the right direction on contamination education. The next slide kind of shows where Waste Management has historically over the past few years shipped material to over the last decade. So a lot of folks probably don't know this, but recycled paper is one of the largest exports the United States has had over the last few years. Waste Management, Recycle America is usually on the top 10, sometimes even the top 5 lists of the largest exporters of the United States. So it's one of the largest materials that the U.S. ships abroad. You can see on the China tab, in 2017, we were shipping nearly 27% of our material to China. At the time, most of that would be cardboard, mixed paper, and even some newsprint back in that time. And then 2020, you see those levels have gone to below 2%. So having a large customer like China essentially step out of the market And then what we're seeing is in September, some of the shipping lines will stop taking orders going to China, as China has slowly, since 2017, prepared for the all-out ban of recycled materials in 2021. And so we're seeing that finally take place. The good news is I think you're seeing a lot more domestic movement, and you can see on our domestic side, we've gone from, you know, roughly 63% material staying domestically to well over 80% in 2020. So there's lots of new capacity coming online for domestic mills. And so I think you're seeing some of that infrastructure shift from the China region to the United States. And that'll help create more jobs and make it a lot easier for our residents to recycle whenever the material can end up here close to home. One of the big pieces that we've really pushed and we've kind of learned when we took some of these export markets for granted is the demand for the recycled material is so important. If you think about it, we've spent so much time on the supply side and folks have goals of zero waste, you know, increasing their diversion that they have away from the landfill. And the one thing we've lacked the focus on is making sure that we have good demand or good end markets for these programs. If you think about it, recycling is a really unique business model. If you were, let's say, General Motors and folks stopped buying, you know, Corvettes or trucks, you'd probably stop buying tires and things of that nature. In the recycling business, even though the demand could come to a complete standstill, we still take in thousands of tons of material every day from consumers that want to do the right thing for the environment. And so we've got to make sure that those demand markets are there to move the material into on a daily basis. And so I think you're seeing a lot of that take place with some of these manufacturers come out and say they're going to use more recycled content in their products and packaging that they have today. You know, Waste Management has worked with some of our cart manufacturers to use post-consumer recycling content in the carts that we purchase for our customers that use a collection of trash and recycling services. And then even the shirt that I'm wearing today is made from plastic PET bottles from Unify that we sell to one of our customers. So there's a lot of great end markets that we're seeing start to develop recently. And I think one of our big takeaways for this message is really to help push and support those brands that are using more recycled content in their materials and in their packaging. One of the most interesting things, I think, is even though I think some would consider with lower commodity prices that we've seen for the last few years, a down cycle for recycling, I can tell you that the Waste Management has actually increased our investments in recycling over the last few years. And, you know, we've got over $1 billion in assets out there today. We've invested over $100 million over the last 12 months and about $100 million in the 12 months prior to that. We've opened up four new recycling facilities throughout the country, one just recently in Salt Lake City. And then earlier this year, we opened up our flagship MRF in Chicago area. And that facility, it's our largest residential recycling investment that Waste Management has done. It's highly automated. We use intelligent sorting. And the idea of that facility is, you know, in the next 5-10 years, we may not know what the recycling stream necessarily looks like and what products we need to pull out. And so this has the ability to program and pull out the products that we choose to, not the old school way where we had a newsprint screen, for example, and you'd have to replace that entire screen when newsprint went away. Nowadays, we can use this with technology. And so we're really excited about that facility as it comes up online. And that will be how we model a lot of our other facilities as well. And then, you know, we've got a little robot over there on the left-hand side. You can see that, you know, robotics is another avenue we're looking at for investments. We've got about five different robot manufacturers today. And by the end of the year, we'll have about 10 to 12 robots actively working in facilities today that we have throughout North America. That's it for my presentation. So I will now turn it over to Peter Wright with the EPA. So thank you all.
Well, thank you very much, Brent, for those comments. And hello, everyone. Glad to be here with you. I would like to say it's a pleasure. And I'd like to thank Daryl Smith and Jermaine, Megan Passenger, for inviting me to speak here today, as well as each of you for joining us today. The solid waste and recycling industry plays a critical role, and an under-recognized one, in keeping the economy running during the pandemic. The pandemic has had people at home, increasing residential volumes of waste while decreasing commercial volumes. And your industry has risen to the challenge to meet these changes and being on the front lines of being exposed to the virus at the same time. And so please accept my personal thanks. And I would also like to thank the National Waste and Recycling Association for being a key partner with EPA in our America Recycles initiative, which focuses on improving education, enhancing recycling infrastructure, strengthening markets, and improving metrics to measure and track recycled materials. So recycling provides valuable feedstock to the entire nation, and it's also a vital source of jobs. More than 750,000 Americans work in the recycling industry, and millions more work in the manufacturing industry supported by recycled materials. Recycling creates domestic markets for materials collected, as you've just seen, and recycling throughout the U.S. strengthens local economies as the U.S. recycling system strengthens. When EPA began in 1970, the national recycling rate was less than 10%. The national recycling rate now has grown to 35%, but I would also sort of say the recycling rate has hit a ceiling of 35%. Growing the U.S. recycling system presents an immense economic opportunity, but to realize this opportunity and the significant environmental benefits that go along with it, we need to come together to address the challenges facing the domestic system. There are several challenges we face in improving the recycling system. Most Americans want to recycle, but confusions exist about what can be recycled and how consumers should do so properly to avoid, is what Brent was talking about, the plague of contamination. Our recycling facilities are ill-equipped to manage today's diverse and evolving waste streams. Investments are needed to enhance and improve our processing capacity here in the United States, and domestic markets need to be strengthened for recycled materials. There is a need to better integrate recycled materials and end-of-life management into product and packaging design. Differing state and local approaches to manage materials, such as what can and cannot be recycled in a given community, and how recycling is defined and measured by states, make it challenging to measure and track our performance nationally. Stakeholders across the recycling system agree that the more consistent measurement methodologies are needed for measuring recycling system performance. The more standardized metrics that can be used are really needed to create meaningful goals and monitor progress. In response to the challenges facing our recycling system, in November 2018, EPA convened 45 organizations who committed to working together to rebuild the nation's recycling system by signing the pledge that you see before you. Today, we have over 220 organizations who have signed this pledge and who are partnering with us to improve the recycling system. EPA is providing national leadership in implementing actions under the National Framework for Advancing the U.S. Recycling System, which the agency released in November of 2019. We continue to support state, local, and tribal governments by providing them with national-level data and tools to assist with decision-making, and we are striving to enhance the demand and supply of recyclables. I'll walk through a few examples of what EPA is doing under each of these areas. EPA is providing national leadership as a convener across the sectors and industries, providing a non-competitive space for diverse perspectives to be shared by facilitating conversations that otherwise may not happen. We are currently implementing collaborative actions under the national framework to advance the U.S. recycling system in the four key areas: promoting education and outreach, enhancing material management and infrastructure, third, strengthening secondary material markets, and finally, enhancing measurement. These key activities have been working on this year in developing a national recycling strategy with stakeholder input, as well as national recycling goals, which we plan to announce in November of this year. We anticipate the release of the national goals and the strategy will inspire additional collaborative action and help us all continue the momentum we're going to need to enhance the recycling system. EPA recognizes that state, local, and tribal recycling programs need assistance in creating economically viable recycling programs. EPA continues to provide national data, information, and tools to support recycling, including our National Sustainable Materials Management Facts and Figures Report, which provides national generation and management estimates for municipal solid waste. Our WARM, W-A-R-M, tool is used to estimate greenhouse gas emissions reductions associated with recycling, and technical assistance through an array of voluntary partnership activities like the WasteWise program. Another way that EPA is providing recycling program, supporting it in recycling programs, is by partnering with the Census Innovation Labs, which have been successful at bringing together government, industry, and communities to unleash creativity and solve national challenges through their Opportunity Project program. Through this effort, EPA is facilitating the development of a new digital tool that aims to efficiently connect recycling facilities to suppliers and manufacturers who are seeking recycled materials. EPA is also working with the Chamber of Commerce Foundation to launch a web-based clearinghouse of recycling-related resources through the Chamber's Beyond 34 initiative. The clearinghouse will feature best practices by state and local governments, as well as funding opportunities to support infrastructure enhancement. We heard from our stakeholders that one of the top challenges in the current field of operations is the challenges posed by COVID. Communities are seeing gloves and masks in the recycling bin or on the ground. EPA has worked with stakeholders to develop common messages on recycling during COVID-19. Based on feedback from our stakeholders, EPA recently issued some public service announcement videos that remind people to not put personal protective equipment in the recycling bin, but rather to dispose of that equipment properly. And so what I'd like to do is play a 30-second video, which is one of the three public service announcements EPA created and encourage users to disseminate in your communities to help educate people on how to recycle right during the pandemic.
Recycling isn't just good for the planet, it also supports the American economy. But there's a shortage of paper and cardboard in the recycling chain. These materials are vital to get supplies to our frontline workers and homes. While more of us are social distancing, we're getting more deliveries. Break down those cardboard and paper containers, keep them clean and dry, and set them out for recycling. This will help manufacturers keep essential supplies flowing across America. Do your part, recycle more, and recycle right.
You can find the links to these recordings on EPA's America Recycles website. Because secondary materials expand beyond state borders, EPA has partnered with other organizations, such as the National Recycling Coalition, to conduct market development workshops across the country. The workshops have connected stakeholders across the value chain to explore solutions to local recycling challenges. The workshops have brought together collaborators, processors, end users, and policymakers to tackle issues like limiting contamination and finding end of life for difficult to recycle materials. Another important mechanism for increasing market values of recyclables is for the government to use our purchasing power to buy recycled material. The federal government has a Buy Recycled program, which EPA is responsible for implementing, called the Comprehensive Procurement Guideline Program, or CPGs. Through the CPGs, EPA-designated products can be manufactured with recycled content, and federal agencies are encouraged to purchase these products, thereby supporting demand for such materials. EPA recently sought comment on its current list of items on the CPG that can be made from recycled materials and are recommended to federal agencies. The comment period closed July 6th, and the agency is currently reviewing and analyzing the comments. EPA encourages all organizations to sign the America Recycles Pledge to work with others across the materials value chain and become actively engaged in improving our recycling system. It is only through our collective action that needed systematic changes will occur. As a participating organization, you can join a work group or volunteer to support implementation of a project under the framework. We hope you'll join us in November at the 2020 America Recycles Summit, an innovation fair where we will announce our national recycling goals and highlight our draft national recycling system. At the time of this recording, EPA is currently evaluating the different options for virtual participation alongside live participation for those who are comfortable and able to join us in person. So please visit our America Recycles website for more updates on that program as details become available. Lastly, I encourage you to support the development of robust recycling programs in your community. For the recycling system to significantly improve, everyone needs to do their part. In closing, I'd like to thank you for your time and attention today. I'm proud of the progress that we've made and look forward to continuing our momentum in 2020 and beyond. And now I'd like to pass over control of the presentation to Bridget.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Peter and Brent. Great to be on a panel with you and Anne as well. Virtual, but nonetheless, really important topics, and very happy to represent New York City in this conversation. Recycling in the time of COVID, I wanted to give a municipality perspective around the ups and downs of recycling and where we stand today as a city. And, you know, we are obviously the largest city in the country, but we still have what's happening for us is not dissimilar to what's happening in other parts of the country, municipalities, counties, you know, really struggling to keep the lights on, to keep our beloved recycling programs running. And here is one perspective. So for those who are not intimately familiar with New York City, we have 8.6 million residents. I would say, though, with COVID, we've had about 5% of a drop currently in people who are living in the city. There's about 3.2 million households, 1.1 million school children. We're just a very, very large, dense city. Many, many buildings, institutions, different types of facilities where we're trying to make recycling successful. We have over 250,000 businesses and nonprofit organizations who also do work in New York City as well as people's homes. We are the largest municipal, Department of Sanitation is the largest municipal sanitation department in the world. Every day we collect more than 10,800 tons of garbage, 2,700 tons of recyclables. We focus our municipal workforce on the residential and institutional waste stream. But collection is only one of the three pillars of what we do. We also plow the snow. So the same trucks that do the collection put plows on the front and plow the snow during the winter. We have 6,500 miles of streets where we plow the snow. And those same miles of streets, we also clean the litter and pick up litter basket material. So we have many duties. Our workforce wears many hats to improve the quality of life, safety, and sustainability of New York City. We also operate transfer stations, and we partner with the private sector to take and process our recycling and our composting. And we regulate the private sector. We do not actually collect commercial waste, with a few minor exceptions, but we do regulate the private, the businesses that do operate in the city, making sure that they are fulfilling the city's waste management goals. A quick diversion into the private hauling system. So the commercial waste sector has at least as much material to pick up as the residential sector during Blue Skies time. And it is a private hauling waste system. It's currently a free market system, and it's in dire straits. About 90% of the commercial waste business was lost during COVID, and it's slowly creeping back, but many, many of these businesses are in need of a lot of support right now as we try to reopen the city from the COVID crisis. And we, this past year was a very important year for New York City in terms of the commercial waste sector. We passed a law that requires us to transform our commercial waste system into a zone system with geographic zones. And the timeline for making that transformation is at risk based on the COVID-19 pause. At the time that this recording is presented, there will likely be more updated information on this, but we are very hopeful that we can pursue a zone system for commercial waste and keep to our timeline because there are many, many benefits to New York City from a sustainability, equity, and safety standpoint. However, COVID has certainly thrown a wrench into a lot of our work, and we're working right now to figure out what's the next step for our commercial waste system transformation. There's some interesting stats, and this is not unusual for waste management systems around the country, municipalities and counties. During COVID, the residential waste stream, so the waste that Department of Sanitation collects in New York City, has gone up. And so this is a map on the right of New York City, and on May 1st, there was an analysis of cell phone usage, and it was determined that largely in higher income areas of the city and largely in Manhattan, there was a huge decrease in the number of residents who are currently living in New York City. So there's been this transformation of flight of COVID evacuees, quote unquote. But at the same time, because businesses are closed and people aren't eating out at restaurants, et cetera, a lot of the waste that we manage has transferred into the residential sector. And there's a few interesting patterns that we've seen so far. This is at data as of early August, that overall with the city, our municipal refuse paper recycling and metal glass plastic recycling have all gone up, and most notably the metal glass plastic stream. So New York City has a dual stream program. We collect paper separate from MGP. It's significant, almost 20% across the board increase in metal glass plastic recycling. We speculate about why that is. Maybe there was less metal scavenging during the pause in New York State, less bottle bill scavenging. We know that on the paper side, there's been a lot more home delivery, so we know that there's a lot more cardboard out there. Although interestingly, you can see with Manhattan that refuse and paper has gone way down, likely due to the population decrease during this time. We don't know what the future will hold, but this is just interesting patterns to look at from the workload capacity of the sanitation department and our trucks, who have been out there collecting day in, day out throughout the entire COVID crisis. So we are, you know, we are lucky as a city. We are guided by very strong policy mechanisms to ensure that we maintain a robust recycling program. So we have a local law that was passed originally in 1989 for mandatory recycling on the residential side, passed in early 90s on the commercial side. And we also operate under a solid waste management plan, which is required of us by New York State. It's a 20-year plan, and it's now 2020, so we have 6 years more under this plan. And the plan requires long-term recycling contracts, multimodal transportation of our goods, borough-based equities. So we have transfer stations in every borough now that are taking and handling the material generated by New Yorkers. And we were required to conduct a commercial waste study, which was, you know, part of the sort of pre-impetus towards understanding how we could transform and improve our commercial waste sector. In addition, we have a very strong policy direction from our mayor's office about climate change, about zero waste to landfills, about the role that waste management plays in a just, strong, and sustainable city. And so these are, you know, policy agenda documents. They're not local laws, but all of these things taken together provide a very strong basis for us to try as hard as we can to keep the lights on, to pursue our work, and keep it going through this and other crises. The reality is we are living climate change. So the idea that we should put a pause on our advancement of how we operate the city related to climate change is moot. You know, we're already living climate change. We already know we have to start making changes for sustainable waste management and other important adjustments, you know, to be able to both respond to, adapt to, and mitigate climate change. And so here's our system. We have a lot of assets and a lot of resources embedded in New York City's system, waste management system. It's not easy. You can't easily take this away. We have our waste disposal network. We have marine transfer stations. We have a Covanta waste to energy facility. We have waste that we export by rail. We do not have any landfills within New York City, so all of our material is exported, all of our refuse is exported. And on the recycling side, similarly, we have a lot of physical infrastructure and assets that help us have a strong program. We have Pratt paper, which actually is not just doesn't just receive our recyclable paper, but it also is a paper mill itself on Staten Island, so that we're able to produce new goods, cardboard boxes, et cetera, from the recycled paper that New Yorkers are putting in their paper bin. About half of our paper also goes to Sims Municipal Recycling, who holds the contract for our metal glass plastic. So we have infrastructure, assets, long-term contracts with both of these facilities. And it's certainly in our interest to keep these programs going to avoid temporary disruptions that could be very costly. Organics, which is the next frontier, is evolving. So our infrastructure is less well developed. Our contracts are not long term. So while we are pursuing both industrial scale composting and anaerobic digestion, and we're leveraging existing assets for that, and we also have educational sites to make sure that we help people understand how composting works and why it's important, this is an area where the infrastructure is less developed. And you will see how all of those things impact what's happened so far. So we are in a budget crisis in New York City. We're not alone. This is happening across the country. And there have been very, very difficult decisions that we've had to make. And this is only the beginning. We're in early August, and there will be more decisions and tough choices that we'll have to make as we move forward as a city. So the status as of today, for the collections, refuse and recycling is intact. We did have a period after 9/11 when there was another fiscal crisis where we actually had to cut recycling partially as well. But for today, refuse and recycling, mandated programs, critical operations are still intact. However, our curbside composting program, which had not been rolled out to the entire city, which was a voluntary program, has been suspended. Street cleaning, so those mechanical brooms and our ability to collect litter baskets, 60% of that budget has been cut in that programming. Snow is our emergency priority. We are, if anything, we are a snow agency first, because that is safety for New Yorkers. But we are working with a tighter workforce. You know, we are not allowed to maintain the staffing levels that we normally do, rehiring to offset attrition. And so our workforce is even tighter than normal. So we're very hopeful and confident that we'll be able to provide New York what we need for snow management, but it's certainly a tighter situation. And then we have other diversion programs that cost money. They're much smaller scale, but come with mandates. And we've been able to, for better or worse, we've been asked to suspend our HHW programming, so both the safe disposal events and the drop-off sites in every borough. And our e-waste appointment-based pickup program is also suspended. And this is a program that we ran to help support the EPR legislation for e-waste recycling at the state level. We had our food scrap drop-off program fully suspended, but after significant advocacy late this spring, early this summer, that funding was partially restored. So we still do have a limited scale food scrap drop-off program. And also intact, and this is where the business case comes into play, is we have two no quote-unquote no-cost contracts for textile recycling and reuse and e-waste recycling that are still intact. And part of the reasoning is that it's not a budget. There's no budget associated beyond some minimal staffing, so we're able to keep that program going. And that's an interesting creative path that we need to think about for other programs of that kind. But generally, the crisis is pushing New York City and all cities and municipalities and counties to focus on core operations. How do we keep the lights on for what we need to do to advance waste management? Drop-off programs, it's a shame that these need to be suspended. Oftentimes, drop-off programs are a stepping stone to larger policies. It's a way to pilot and test what people will do. It's a way to garner behavior change by New Yorkers who may not be as familiar with the ability to donate textiles and gently used goods and food scraps and how to do that. So it is a shame that these are suspended, and we're hopeful that we're able to revive them sooner rather than later. The Household Hazardous Waste Program is extremely popular in the city, and people, I think, feel very committed to avoiding hazardous materials going into the back of our trucks. As was mentioned by Brent, helium tanks, propane tanks, they can cause explosions. A year ago, we had a sanitation worker with shrapnel in his body because of a helium tank explosion. And so, we're eager to restart those types of programs as soon as we can. And then just to say, the fact that we have not only a paper recycling facility in Pratt, but also a paper mill to actually manufacture new goods that are actually in high demand at this time, cardboard boxes, this strategy is proving resilient. And so to the extent that it's possible to co-locate the receipt of recyclables and the ability to manufacture new products from those recyclables is really something that where it's possible, we should be doing it because it makes it a much more resilient type of program. Sims Municipal Recycling takes, like I said, all of our metal glass plastic, and contamination is creeping up. And this is not just due to COVID. We are seeing, a high amount of cardboard and, unfortunately, some missorting of cardboard in our MGP streams. But an additional thing that's happening is an increase in the amount of multi-layer, quote-unquote, junk containers that aren't necessarily junk, but they don't have there's no real path to recycling those materials, and there's no demand for those materials in the recycling market. And so we're really trying to figure out what is the economical path forward for the materials that we do collect in our program. And it's something that is extremely important. It's was kicked off by China policy. COVID is exacerbating, the challenges of maintaining a program where you have contamination and have to pay for residue. We don't want to reduce and constrict what we collect. We don't want to have to change, retrain New Yorkers. But we need better markets. And so we're really pushing to figure out what are the ways that we can help support improvements in the material that we collect. We collected 650,000 tons of recyclables last year. So if you need a critical mass, we've got it. So the question then becomes, how do we create a situation where there's demand for that material? So really, the questions are, where can policy help? Where can government management help during the fiscal crisis? And, one of the things that we've had a lot of conversations over time, both with government and with the private sector, about extended producer responsibility in the United States. What should that look like? Should it be at a state level? Should it be at a federal level? We really hope to advance the concept. We've done it. We have existing laws for particular hazardous material types, but for packaging and paper products, maybe this is a way for us to help pool investment from the private sector in a way that actually advances the infrastructure goals that we need across municipal systems and across the private sector systems, so that we actually have a stronger, more resilient basis for doing recycling in the U.S. And then recycle content mandates. I mean, this is not a new story, but you need to drive demand. You need people to want to buy the supply that we're collecting to be able to make this actually a functional program. So recycled content mandates are something we're pursuing through our environmentally preferable procurement policies. It's also something we're pursuing at the state level through legislation. So we're really hopeful that we can get support to drive demand. There already are voluntary commitments about recycled content. Let's make it required. Let's make people have to actually live up to those commitments so that we can actually find outlets and markets for these materials. And then obviously figuring out what is the creative way, what's the path for multi-layer, new generation, highly designed, highly engineered containers and products. How do we recycle them? We need to figure out the path and pool resources so that we have the infrastructure to handle packaging and products moving forward. And again, it needs creative leadership at all levels. We are in a real fight to maintain, keep the lights on with our programming, despite our strong policies and our infrastructure investments. You know, we need federal help on the stimulus. We need to have leadership that really prioritizes the maintenance of these critical municipal programs. These are utilities for the city. You know, we have to keep moving the piles no matter what the markets look like in China. We've committed to these programs, and so we need a path forward to make them viable moving forward. And with that, I will end there, and thank you so much. And Anne, I'll pass it over to you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bridget. And I wanted to start off by saying thank you all for such great presentations. I think you really set the stage and kind of holistically showed all the different issues that are facing the recycling industry. So I'd like to start off with a more of a general question. I think I heard from all three of you that demand is a big part of the answer. So if demand is the answer, I guess this is more like a Jeopardy question. What is the question, and how do we create that stronger demand for the recycled material? I think we talked a little bit about a couple of solutions, but let me start with Brent, and then Peter, if you and Bridget will add on to whatever Brent has to say.
Yeah, thanks, Anne. And great presentations. I really enjoyed both Bridget, Peter. Thank you guys for taking the lead on that. The demand side is really important, and creating sustainable homes, I guess, is how we classify that. Making sure that you know, we're not competing with the price of, you know, virgin price of oil, for example, into those end markets, because then we may sell into that particular market for a few months, and then they may go to a cheaper solution for their inbound material. So one of the pieces that we look at is when we talk to our municipalities, our customers, is how can you improve recycling economics? And that's actually buy recycled products or packaging. Make sure you support those brands. I think we mentioned when Peter hosted us at the EPA last year that, you know, they're doing something. Bridget mentioned Pratt. So the U.S. Postal Service, all their boxes are made from Pratt Industries. And so those are 100% recycled content boxes. So the federal government, as the largest purchaser, can start with making sure that practices like that happen, so they can continue to buy and support those brands that use recycled content. Local governments can do that. Even companies like waste management can do that. And we've committed, you know, the carts was one example. And we're also looking at uniforms and vests that are made out of recycled material that can help out. And I guess I'll end it on. So I think that it's important that in their procurement practices, people exercise that. And I'll give you a quick example of how it actually works. If you look at the price of natural high density plastic, it's actually higher than aluminum. And the reason why is because we're starting to see some of these brands that have made these goals and commitments to actually increase the demand that they have for that material. And so if you look at the chart for that, the prices is just off the charts now for natural high density. And it goes back to showing that programs that have been suffering over the last 2 years because of low commodity prices, this is where demand really pays off, because it's going to equate to higher prices for our customers' programs that can make them more sustainable in years to come.
Sure. Thank you. And thank you, Brent, for the reference to one of the things the federal government does, you know, which I mentioned, and that is in our procurement guidelines. You know, another thing that we think about, though, you know, is very closely tied into demand is the supply, which, again, I think both of you have talked about that in sometimes to drive demand, you know, the manufacturers need to know that they're going to have a consistent, high quality supply of materials in which to make their products. And so that gets back to, you know, Brent, again, that you started talking about it and showed the photo of contamination. I mean, you know, the things that we can do to strengthen the system to create a better supply of, if you will, the raw materials, that, you know, the high quality recyclables, you know, helps to create the demand, because the manufacturers then can understand they're going to be able to advertise their products as having recyclable content, because they know that they can get their hands on enough recyclable content to make their products with that recycled content. So again, you know, improving the supply is also, we think, very important.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that, you know, we have a lot of conversations about quality and the need to improve quality, but quantity is just as critical. So if you need to know that there's a critical mass of amount of material that is of a certain quality to be able to really drive this industry forward. And so I worry when there's discussion of constricting programs and constraining programs rather than figuring out ways to mechanically and otherwise improve the quality of the volume that we're collecting, because it is difficult to change individual behavior. And we put our best foot forward. We all are working on, you know, messaging around contamination. But ultimately, we need volume, high volumes of material that can be sorted such that it creates like valuable, you know, quality bales of material, and hopefully, you know, demand and supply like can kind of work in concert to try to create that. The other thing that I think about a lot, so natural HDB, for example, that is, it's great that there's a good market for it. We need more products coming into our recycling system that are made out of it then. And so part of the challenge is as the design of products evolves, we are being challenged on creating that volume of supply of the highly recyclable products. And so this is where we try to keep pulling in product designers into the conversation saying, innovate, but think about it from the context of the full circle. And if you want to be putting recycled content in your product, know that the source of that's coming from whatever product you're creating and giving to us on the back end. And so needing to keep pulling that that complete loop of the supply chain around. You know, if you're taking HDPE and creating new products, it's great. But if what you're giving us as new products are multi-layer materials, that there's no chance that we're ever going to be able to extricate it for recycling. And obviously not all materials can be infinitely recycled, but we just need to be thinking about along those lines.
Let me follow on with this a little bit more detail. You know, I know all of you are probably aware that AFMPA just earlier this summer came out with their definitive guide on recycling pizza boxes. And in their cheese and grease study, which I love, they concluded that even with some of that, it wasn't going to be problematic because it's such a small quantity. And yet we're talking about trying to improve quality of the supply, and yet we now have a study saying, well, maybe it's not that big a deal. And then obviously we have an export market that has a much higher specification. So how do we address things like that? I mean, are we being consistent here in how we're messaging? And I'll throw it out open to any of you.
I mean, I feel like it depends, right? So if you're an extremely manual program and you're hand sorting or whatever it is, and you have a regional set of buyers, you may have a different set of rules. And so I think for better or worse, it's not one uniform system. There's different, I mean, Waste Management has put incredible investment into high tech, you know, robust facilities. That looks very different from a rural, you know, MRF where people drop into a bay, you know, they separate their recycling and then it just gets directly baled. So I think for better or worse, this is the hard part, right, that we can't ever solve for, which is one answer to each of these questions. Wish there was.
Yeah, and I'll just add on. I kind of view contamination like that in two different buckets. You know, a piece of cheese on cardboard doesn't harm anybody. But a propane tank or a helium tank, like Bridget mentioned, a battery that could cause a fire and completely destroy $30, $40 million facilities. When I look at contamination, that's where I kind of lean on you have to have strict guidelines on that. Again, you know, with the amount of cardboard we want all the material to be clean and dry, but I'll take a little piece of cheese over a propane tank any day.
Well, and I think this also emphasizes, the real challenge of consumer education, right? Because obviously, there are very different markets, and so there are different jurisdictions have different abilities to handle different kinds of materials, different levels of contamination, and in the end, that becomes, very confusing and I myself have used the pizza box example many times to sort of illustrate the, you know, the range of challenges we face, you know, in terms of educating consumers, you know, and actually I use it to measure, you know, to talk about all four of our work areas. But, you know, again, I think it's, you know, you do get the sense so that by focusing on it, we're actually making a lot of improvements. And when we know what we have the pizza box in front of us, I think we can work on it. It, you know, I think, you know, Bridget talked about some of the really particularly challenging items in the recycling stream that I don't think we've yet quite figured out how to address.
Peter, you've been working with EPA on the National Recycling Framework and trying to draw a lot of different stakeholders together under one roof to talk about recycling. So as you bring all these different stakeholders under one umbrella, what can you tell us more about what the advantages of that is and what EPA is moving, how EPA is moving forward to try and advance recycling through the effort?
Great. No, thank you for that opportunity. So, you know, I'm really impressed, and I want to thank, you know, all of those who can, you know, who contributed countless hundreds of thousands of hours, collected many, many thousands to, you know, working on, working with EPA and their fellow stakeholders, you know, to improve the system. You know, one of the things I've just seen a recent demonstration of is the very sophisticated, complicated mapping of the recycling system. You know, because it recognizes that to really make systematic improvements, we need a much more sophisticated understanding of the entire system to be able to then, understand how it flows, and then eventually to be able to take measurements at different points so that we can make intelligent, it's not necessarily just the government, you know, making intelligent choices about, you know, where do investments make the most sense, where do policies make the most sense, you know, where are, you know, and then, you know, where are we making real improvements, where are we stuck? So, I mean, we've seen a lot of great work around certainly creating the mapping. There are discussions going on right now about, you know, establishing the goals, maybe at the large national recycling goal, as well as those goals that sit underneath that. That need to be worked on in order to achieve, you know, really substantial improvement. And so we're about to put out, before too terribly long here, then our national recycling, you know, the strategy for comment. So look forward to, you know, again, we appreciate all the work that's been done, and we look forward to receiving a lot of comment on this work before we move it to finalization.
Bridget, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is to try and figure out how we harmonize lists. Obviously, New York City is a large municipality, and maybe it's less critical because you have such a large amount of material coming in. But for other municipalities, each coming with their own separate lists, this adds to a lot of the confusion among people where, you know, they might just end up giving up. You know, at what level should we be harmonizing lists, especially given the availability of end markets being variable from one area to the next?
It's a really good question, and New York City made a choice in 2013 to go big and to try to simplify for residents as much as possible what we're asking them to collect. We never use the resin code numbers. Only confuses people. They aren't on all products, and it doesn't reflect a lot of the materials. We expanded our program. It used to be bottles only for plastic, and then we said, give us all your rigid plastic. We knew, if we said that, based on our waste characterization study, that we would be getting some material that we wouldn't necessarily be able to market, but we knew that we were also collecting at such a volume that we would be able to try as hard as we could to find outlets and markets for that material. And 85% of what we collect, based on our last waste characterization study, was marketable of the plastics. So we felt that we would get more of the good stuff by building in and, frankly, paying for the fact that we would have to handle other items as residue. We are seeing that contamination rate creep up. And part of the reason we think is the change of design of products. So products that used to be made out of metal or glass are now made out of plastic or multi-laminate material. So we're looking at, okay, what does it look like now? And we're considering, basically, if our contamination rate goes above 20%, the city is on the hook to help pay for the disposal of that material above 20%. So we're contractually obligated to handle what we have. Regarding alignment with other programs that maybe haven't made that policy choice to go as broad, we actually had a very interesting year this past year in New York State, where the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation put together a New York Recycle Right program. And we said, okay, how do we align even at New York State on education? And so we said, what are the 12 items, one item a month, that we can all agree on? And we said, let's push out those messaging once a month. So batteries bad. We all agree. No one's confused about that. So part of it's like, we know contamination is a problem. Let's get all the things that we all agree is contamination. Let's start there. We also talk about cardboard is good. There's more cardboard. Get it in your recycling bin. So we've found a way within New York State to try to align, even though all the programs aren't identical. And I've had discussions about, well, what does it look like moving forward if you wanted to actually legislate or through rulemaking have like an aligned list? And so for us, our preference is that we have an aligned list that we could go above if we chose to, but that there would be a minimal list that all the counties and municipalities would agree on. And you can imagine it is hard even to create that minimum list. But we've been looking at other states that have attempted to do this with a lot of interest to figure out if we could do it in New York State as well.
Brent, do you have anything to add about the aligned list or harmonizing lists?
Yeah, the one thing that we tried to do is make recycling simple. And while you're right, there's thousands of municipalities that have different items on their acceptable list. The one thing we focus on through our education campaign is paper, cardboard, bottles, and cans can be recycled in every program. And so a lot of times we'll focus on, hey, just get the basics right. And when people come to us with new products or new packaging they want to recycle, then I always look back and I say, the recycling rate for like a PET bottle is still only in the 30% range, right? Let's work on the items we know have good end markets that still have relatively low recycling rates and focus on those items. And so if we get our municipality just to focus on recycling more of the basics that have great end markets, that's kind of where we push towards, because it's confusing out there. We, whether you're moving or whether you go from municipality to municipality, different things are acceptable. And it also depends on, the markets that are available to process those materials. Glass is always a great example that comes up. So it's a challenge, but sticking with the basics and making it simple, I think, is a clean message.
Okay, well, let's ask one last question for the entire group. So this is going to be a two-parter, and you can take whichever part you want to prioritize and focus on that. So obviously, over the last couple of years, we've had tremendous challenges, and there have been any number of new initiatives that have been proposed. What new initiatives do you think will be the most successful at basically changing the way recycling is done in the future and making it more sustainable, both economically as well as environmentally? And as the second part of that question is kind of more fun. If you had a magic wand and could just change anything you wanted to make recycling more sustainable, what is it that you would do to make your magic wand? And with that, I'll let whoever wants to jump in and start that. Or I'll call on one of you if you don't want to. Peter, go ahead.
I'm not sure which part of the question now that I'm answering, but the one thing I think that makes me most hopeful is the fact that the level of awareness kind of across the recycling system, and that includes the consumer residential households, but certainly in other sectors, I mean, it is so much higher. I think people are much more focused on it. I think the concerns that were mentioned by Brent and you know, came up otherwise about the, you know, the challenge of international markets, I think, you know, has certainly galvanized, you know, particularly local officials across the country, even, you know, in cities, you know, teeny percentages of the size of New York, to really focus on these issues. They're looking for solutions. You know, I think that kind of gives me great hope. In terms of, you know, I'm not sure that I know what the magic wand would be. I think it's, I think the magic is everybody kind of coming together and realizing that, you know, that it's a, we really need to work a system that works together so that, you know, a lot of people have different views about whether something ought to be mandated or not. I think the system is probably big enough that it can kind of include, you know, encompass a lot of that. You know, so maybe the magic is a line of new products that you know, that that nobody thought of you know, making before, but really rely on recycled materials that drive demand. But I'll let others get their final words in.
Brent.
Great. Yeah. Thanks. That's a good one, Peter. So I think on the initiative side, I would say, you know, a combination of what the demand challenge from the Association of Plastic Recyclers, as well as, you know, Peter's for the EPA, the America Recycles Day pledge. I think all those holding folks accountable to saying they're going to buy and support more, you know, recycled content, and they're going to invest in, you know, really taking a hard look at this and setting their goals that they're going to be held accountable for. So, you know, next year when Peter invites us back, he can say, hey, how did you all do? I think that accountability between colleagues really helps out, and I think that's going to really drive some of this demand and people taking it seriously for, you know, making sure that the products and packaging they put out in the marketplace does have a good end market. On the magic wand side, that's a tough one. I guess the somewhat on what Peter said, you know, it maybe if you can make a magic wand that would make all the packages out of gold, your recycling rate be 100% because everybody's going to want to take their gold in and get reimbursed for it, right? So somewhere you back down to what's economically feasible from the gold measure of that, and you say, hey, what can we use that's very consistent, that has a great end market and has value to these municipal programs that we can keep on making sure they move forward?
Brent, I just read an article that's called Cardboard Brown Gold, and they were saying that it was getting stolen left, right, and center. So it just brings a whole host of problems if you're calling it gold.
Yeah, there you go.
I see a children's book in the making, spinning your cardboard into gold or something. So I completely agree. The magic wand and the economic argument, it's kind of the same for me. We need a business case. We need to strengthen the business case across the supply chain, across the system for recycling. And if I could throw a magic wand and say that there's money to be made in each step of the process, that's what I would want to do. It's going to cost us money each step of the process, but then if you're going to invest the money, you want to make sure you're getting something out of it as a city, as, you know, in terms of your how much it costs you to contract with your vendors from the MRF, how much is it going to cost you, and how much are you going to make from selling those bales? Like, we need that business case stronger. It's just not strong enough, and we're competing against a lot of very difficult, you know, factors. And then I would say, just for fun, somehow we need people to realize that bowling balls shouldn't go with the metal, glass, and plastic. We get too many of those. So, but I think business case is really, you know, and what are the, you know, is there government role to help influence that business case? Yeah, probably. But in the end, you need everyone along the system to want to be in the business, because they're actually going to, you know, generate revenue. So.
Okay, great. So I think that's about it for our ups and downs of recycling. To kind of sum up a little bit, you know, I heard a lot of downs, you know, starting from what happened with China's national sword a couple of years ago. Contamination rates could be increasing, but possibly decreasing as awareness improves. Some of the ocean plastics and COVID has certainly not helped, but I've heard, you know, pleasantly some ups as well. You know, there's been a tremendous amount of new investments in infrastructure. We've seen some improvements in our domestic end markets from different materials. We've got PSAs coming out from the EPA on a national level, and we also have consumer product guidelines for purchasing, and we look forward to seeing what you're going to start recommending that the various federal agencies start purchasing. And, you know, we're hearing more about resiliency being increased with a lot of these end markets. So I think, you know, I'm really pleased. I expected this to be more of the downs of recycling than the ups, but I certainly heard a lot of ups from all three of you. So I appreciate you giving me some optimism for the upcoming year. So thank you so much for participating in this session.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Thank you so much, Anne.